Right, okay, we are looking at Sedra Vayeshev. So this is our new approach, which is that we are looking at the Sedra of the week for when we meet. And it's a very special parasha. Just find the place over here. Well, there are a lot of dramatic things that happen in Sedra Vayeshev. And in fact, the very opening Rashi, you see it says, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz mugorei aviv. Jacob dwelt in the land of the sojourning of his father, Yitzchak, Isaac. Be'eretz Canaan, in the land of Canaan. And there is the whole idea of Vayeshev. It's the commentators say that Vayeshev Yaakov dwelt, Yaakov wanted to dwell peacefully. So here he is. He's had a very troubled life in different ways. He spent all those years with Laban, his uncle, which was with great difficulty. He had to face the anger of his brother Esau. And now he is this patriarchal figure dwelling with his sons. At this point, so the sages say, Bikesh Yaakov Leshev B'Shalva. Jacob wanted to dwell in peace. Kafatza Lav Rugzo Shel Yosef. Immediately there emerged, there jumped on him the anger, the pain, all the very tragic events concerning Joseph, the disappearance of his son Joseph, which is what happens in this Sedra. So it's interesting that a parsha, where in fact they're very troubled events, everything that happens. First of all, the distinction between Joseph and his brothers, and the brothers are jealous of him. And he dreams dreams which make his brothers more jealous of him. And then they decide to sell him. They catch him, they sell him. And then Judah feels very bad, feels very guilty that he allowed Joseph to be sold. So he goes away from everyone else. And he lives in some remote place. And he gets married and he has two sons. And then there's the whole question one of the sons marries Tamar. And this son dies, and now Tamar is she's supposed to marry by levirate marriage. She's supposed to marry the other son. Just 1 second. So there's three sons actually. 1 second. So she had a son Er, and another son Onan, and another son Shelah. Er died. Onan committed the sin of Onanism. He was supposed to marry her, marry Tamar, through levirate marriage, and he didn't. He didn't want to allow the seed to go inside her, because he knew that the child that would be born wouldn't be called after him, so he died as well. And then there's the whole question of Judah not wanting to let his third son marry her. Maybe we'll come back to this story. So that's another troubled aspect in this Sedra. Then we follow the story of Joseph. And Joseph is sold into Egypt. And there in Egypt, he is with Potiphar, and there's Potiphar's wife who desires him. And he won't give in to her, so she accuses him of making advances to her, and so he's thrown into prison. So all that happens in this Sedra. And nonetheless, the Lubavitcher Rebbe points out, it's called Vayeshev. And he dwelt there tranquilly. So,
but he wasn't tranquil, he was the most...
It's a complete obverse of tranquility. So the way the Rebbe explains it is, in fact, as we go through the whole process of Joseph being sold into Egypt, and finally the brothers coming to Egypt, and then him sending them backwards and forwards, and making them bring his younger brother Benjamin, and then sending them off again, and then saying that Benjamin stole his goblet, and he's going to keep Benjamin with him, and then comes the Judah, who feels responsible that he sold him, let him be sold. Judah came and said, take me instead of Benjamin, which was a kind of tit for tat, that instead of the sons, it's all a drama between the sons of Leah and the sons of Rachel. Because Joseph and his brother Benjamin and the sons of Rachel, and Judah is the other, and Reuben, the ones who were involved in selling him. Reuben is a slightly different question. We'll come to him in a minute. But they're all the sons of Leah. So it's a drama between the sons of Leah and the sons of Rachel. So when Judah, the leading son of Leah, says, take me as a slave instead of Benjamin, that enables the denouement to take place. And Joseph says, I am Joseph. And that's, and suddenly, and this is like two centers ahead, and they recognize him, and it's wonderful. And then Jacob comes with his whole family down to Egypt, and then Jacob lives the 17 most peaceful years of his life in Egypt. And so the Vayeshev over here, the tranquility, is looking ahead.
The last 17 years.
It's looking ahead.
Right.
And so there's that sense that the struggles of the moment, yes, they're struggles, but really it's the tranquility of the future. And we should always be able to have this double vision, that whatever the struggles of the moment, there's the tranquility of the future. And the ultimate belief of the Jewish people is that the future will be tranquil, it will be the coming of the Messiah, and the land, and the world will be filled with knowledge of God, and will be peaceful and happy. So there's always that Vayeshev Yaakov, that sense of tranquility, even though at that particular moment we might be engaged in the most terrible storms of conflict and struggle of different kinds. So that's a little comment just on the first word. So Vayeshev, so there is Jacob living in the land of the sojourn of his father, in the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan, it's very interesting, the whole process of transforming the land of Canaan into Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. Jacob himself is Israel, his other name is Israel. Now it's interesting that Jacob's name was changed. That was in last week's seven. He was wrestling with the angel, and the angel said, your name will no longer be Jacob, it'll be Israel, Yisrael, because you have wrestled, or Sarita, you have conquered Elohim v'anashim, men and gods, men and angels. So other people had their names changed in earlier parts of the Torah, like Abraham and Sarai. So Avram became Avraham and Sarai became Sarah. But once they changed their name, we never see them referred to again with their earlier name. They're always with their new name. Whereas Jacob is sometimes Jacob, like here, and sometimes Israel. And there's another interesting comment that Jacob and Israel, Jacob is the aspect which is struggling, which faces all kinds of conflict. Yisrael is the one who has successfully finished the struggle at any particular stage. It might be one stage, then there's going to be another struggle. But we also combine the Jacob and the Israel. So there's the dimension when we are facing the struggle, and then there's the dimension when we're relaxed. For example, Shabbat. We can have a week full of the most terrific conflict of different kinds. Then with the help of God, we come to the seventh day, to Shabbat, lighting Shabbat candles, making Kiddush, suddenly a different atmosphere, and then we're at that moment we're Yisrael, but then we come back into the week and again with Jacob, ready for trouble. And the concept of Jacob is that there's the Yud, look at his name, Yaakov. What does Akev mean? Ayin Kuf Bet?
Heel.
Heel, yes. The lowest part of the body, which, and also the most insensitive part. I'm told in a psychology lecture I once attended that if you took two needles, two pins, and if you put them on your finger, you can feel very clearly, is it one pin or two pins? But if you put them on your heel, if you have someone else doing this, you can't tell whether it's one pin or two pins, because the heel is so insensitive. And I think the sages call it the Malach HaMavet Shebaguf, the angel of death in the body, which is interesting because then there's the idea of Achilles' heel. Mm-hmm. With Achilles was so strong, and yet he was killed by an arrow in his heel. So that's so the heel is very low. The Yud of the name of Jacob is the first letter of a very important word, according to this Hasidic insight. Can anyone tell me which word?
God, the name of God.
Yes, Mila's got it immediately. That's the name of God, Yud and He and Vav and He, the tetragrammaton, the ineffable name of God. The first letter of the name of God is the Yud, which goes together with the heel, which is the lowest and least sensitive part of the body. The nature of Jacob is to draw from the most exalted realm of the Yud, of the name of God, the highest point of the name of God, which Kabbalistically represents the Svirah Chochmah, wisdom. That's the dot of the Yud, and the thorn on top of the Yud, the Tag, the crown of the Yud, represents Keter, the even higher crown, the highest level of the Svirot, and that comes all the way down into the heel, because that's the task of the Jew, to draw godliness from the highest level down into the most earthly and most mundane and worldly aspect of life. So that's Jacob. And in order to do that, there's a tremendous struggle in order to do that in a proper way. If one wanted to just live in a hide away and somehow live a very spiritual life without anything else going on, maybe it wouldn't be so difficult. But we have this challenge to draw the spirituality into the materiality. So that's the name Yaakov. Now, next verse. Ele toldot Yaakov Yosef. These are the generations of Yaakov, and it now tells us the story of Joseph, and it launches into the story. These are the generations of Yaakov, Yosef ben Shvay Shana. Amelie, would you like to read?
Ele toldot Yaakov. יוסף בן 17 שנה היה רואה את אחיו בצון, והוא נער את בני בלהה ואת בני זלפה, נשי אביו, ויבא יוסף את דיבתם רעה אל אביהם.
Okay, can you translate?
And Joseph, this is the chronicle of Yaakov. Yosef is 17 years old and he is a shepherd. It says et echav, which means a shepherd's of.
It's interesting. Yeah,
of the brothers.
So this I was thinking that, but it's normally translated with his brothers.
Yeah, with a flock, and he's. They say it again, and he's a boy. He's a na'ar, and the son of Bnei, the sons of Bilha, and the sons of Zilpa, the wives of his father. And Yosef brought Dibatam, and Yosef brought Lashonara almost, isn't it?
Yes,
Lashonara, to their fathers.
Yes. Now, the thing is, it does seem, according to the explanations of Rashi based on the Midrash, there was a very hierarchical structure among these brothers, which you could say is a problematic aspect of our history. You have the sons of Leah. He is the son of Rachel, who is on the spot, as it were. He has a much younger brother called Benjamin. Benjamin is younger and doesn't appear in this part of the story. And his mother Rachel unfortunately died after giving birth to Benjamin. So there is Joseph more or less alone. Meanwhile, you have the sons of Leah. Now, Leah and Rachel were both full wives. The other two, Bilhah and Zilpah, were concubines. So there is a sense of them lording it over the concubines, the sons of the concubines. And so therefore, the children of Leah would call, according to the Midrash, they would call the children of the concubine slaves, servants. They would speak about them in a derogatory way.
Were they Israelites? Bilhah and Zilpah?
Well, they were the daughters of Laban from a concubine. So he had a wife, and through that wife came Leah and Rachel, and he had a concubine, through the concubine came Bilhah and Zilpah. So they were all half-sisters together.
It's a terrible family dynamic.
So Jacob really did sort of a wholesale appropriation.
Terrible.
Keep the family together.
But they want so much to choose for all the time.
That's also true. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sure there are other explanations to all of that.
Well, I mean, obviously there's a problem over here because Jacob is marrying sisters.
Yeah.
Particularly Rachel and Leah, two sisters.
And then, and the other two are also, or it's all within one pot.
Mm. Yeah, he married two special sisters, but he was not married to them, to the concubine, it says.
But he does say Nishe, he does say his wives, so they are, he has children by them.
Okay, yes, you're right.
Yeah. There is a discussion about the how come he could marry two sisters. I mean, one simple answer is it's before the Torah was given, and it's in the Torah. Later on in the Torah, it says you mustn't marry two sisters. Even in a time when people are allowed to marry more than one wife, or in a region, they're not allowed to marry two sisters. However, so you could say that he...
I said Ariel Sharon.
No, but this is a different story. The wife died, and it's okay. The sister, you know.
Yeah, that's just going to ask about
some Ashkenazi
it
family
is considered
do it.
Normal to marry the sister if your brother's
dead,
passed away.
Yes.
So
it's a customary, actually, yes. in some.
You married the sister.
Well, I mean, this is the idea.
Yes.
One second. Elaborate.
But not in life.
But the thing is that there's a tradition that Jacob kept the Torah. We generally look at the patriarchs that they did keep the Torah. Abraham kept Pesach, even Lot in the city of Sodom when the angels came, he was eating matzah. He was, because it was Pesach at that time. So, if Jacob kept the laws of the Torah, how could he marry two sisters?
But how long Pesach came much
later?
Yes, of course, it's from Pesach, it hasn't yet happened. And yet, if you have spiritual insight, you can see that this time of year is...
It doesn't actually say in the Torah that he was eating matzah.
It says he was eating matzah. Yeah. And Rashi says, see, here we have it. So this is in Vayera.
It said, but not in the Torah, Tali.
Sorry?
It said that he was eating matzah, but not in the Torah.
Oh, no, it says in the Torah. Let me find it. So,
it's a very complicated book.
Yes. And we're talking how many years? More than 1,000 years before?
Mm-hmm.
No.
You see, and Vayivtzabon, this is Lot persuading the angels to come to his house. Vayivtzabon Ma'od, he pressed them very much. Vayasur Elav, and they turned aside to his house. Vayavor El Beito. The two angels came to his house. Vayas lahem mishte. He made for them food. Umatzot afa. And he baked matzot vayochelu. And they ate. So why did they have matzot? Rashi says. See, you click on Rashi.
Should have been just a flat bread.
You had to escape Sodom. Yeah. You didn't have time to bake proper food.
And they arrived very unexpected, isn't
it? Well, he did beg them to come.
Umatzot afa, Rashi says, Pesach haya. It was Pesach. And there's a little extra comment over there. So, here.
It's during the time they're still in Egypt,
right? No.
This
is hundreds of years before.
So this is
hundreds of years before. This is before.
This is before he's God's prisoner. Yes, yes, yes. Relatedly so becomes Pharaoh.
So yeah. It's several hundred years.
The whole
it's at least 200. It's 200 and something years before. Yeah. Or 300.
So 200. Why does it say Pesach?
Well, because the point is,
it doesn't. No,
well,
it doesn't.
No, Rashi
says it's basic.
So the idea is that they're able to see that spiritually that this is Pesach. That you see Pesach that happens to us, a historical event of us being in Egypt and being released from Egypt. That's what takes place on our level of existence. But there's a spiritual dimension. There's a spiritual dimension as well. And that spiritual dimension is there. It's as if, within some kind of cosmic or spiritual realm. So there's the concept that these days have that particular sanctity. So,
was it Lot?
That was Lot, yes, Lot.
Well, you can also argue that he used to eat matzot irrespective of what happened.
You can indeed, yes, that would be
a good one. But
this is probably the most, yes, I think so.
That would be an easy way out.
But aren't there also some things about Abraham in the Torah which is very clearly references to Pesach?
Well, you see, there's Lushi Va'asi Ugot. He says to his wife Sarah, knead the dough and make Ugot Matzah. That's how it's understood. That was also Matzah. But
say Ugot Matzah or just Ugot, which they took to be Matzah?
Well, there it says it's Ugot, but it's understood to be Ugot Matzah. That's how it sounds.
pushing the drums of
yes.
You know, if anyone would describe to let's say Hillel, who lived 2,000 years ago, the way that we live today and the things that we've gone through, he would say, pushing the drums.
I can say it. 50 years old since I was 10 to today. Yeah,
it's we live beyond rationality. Mila v'yom yashna. It's an amazing thing. All right, so... Oh, so the thing is, if he's keeping the Torah, why then did he marry two sisters? So at the beginning he wanted to marry Rachel. And Rachel knew this. Rachel loved him. He loved her and she loved him.
And he was cheated.
And he was cheated. And he was given Leah instead. Now, if he says, I'm going to be too frum, I'm too frum to marry you because I am keeping the laws of the Torah the way they're going to be given to the Jewish people, and therefore I'm not allowed to marry two sisters. Now, that would be cruel in relation to the laws that he does have to keep. You see, he was keeping Jewish law, the future Torah law, as a kind of hidur, a hidur mitzvah, an extra level of a mitzvah. But the basic relationship with another person, that he's promised to marry Rachel and he wants to marry Rachel, that's something he has to keep according to the seven Noahide laws. That he definitely has to keep. So therefore, instead of refusing to marry her on the basis of a hidur mitzvah, an extra subtlety, he says, look, the hidur mitzvah will have to be transcended and we're going to get married because I said I was going to marry you, and according to the seven Noahide laws, I should marry you. And that in fact indicates to us how careful we should be in our relationships with other people, that sometimes we can let our little hidurim, our extra strictnesses, get in the way of relationships. So, of course, it's a dangerous area and one has to think very carefully, but we need to be able to recognize the other person and the need of the other person. And sometimes hidurim needs, we have to think to ourselves carefully about those hidurim. That's how you have the whole idea of the Babit Shluchim, going to live in a place, in a town where there's hardly another person who keeps Shabbat. Now, a very basic way of understanding Judaism is you have to live in a Jewish community. Go and live in a place where there's no Orthodox congregation and people are not, you haven't got a whole Shabbat observing group of people and education for children and things like this. But no, for the need, for the concern for the Jewish people living in that place, the Shluchim will go and live in a place which, from the Hidurim, from the point of view of Hidurim, they should be living in Northwest London. That's but no, they go and live in Mumbai or something like that. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a Malava Malka where the new Shliach to Mumbai was there. He gave a riveting talk, absolutely riveting. How he had gone to Mumbai years ago when he was a student in yeshiva. And he went for 6 months and he helped out over there and he was very, very impressed with the Holzberg, Aleihem HaShalom. And it was wonderful being there. And then time passed on, he went on, he went back to yeshiva and got married eventually. And then someone called him up and said, this after the whole tragedy, which he felt very personally, but in a sense so did everyone. But he felt it particularly because he had been there, been so close with them. So someone phoned him up and said, would you like to come and be the Shliach in Mumbai, the new Shliach? Mm. And he's got a job already. He's working for his father-in-law, who's a Shliach in Israel, and he's now got a nice Beit Chabad somewhere. I'm not sure where it was, but everything going very well and very happy and pleasant, not really interesting. And then they phoned again, like a week later, 2 weeks later. And he also, you know, he tells his wife what they filmed about. And his wife said, but if the Rebbe would ask us to go to Mumbai, we'd go, wouldn't we?
Very well put.
And he said, that made me start thinking. And they began thinking about it. And now they're in Mumbai.
I had a very interesting luncheon once with the Israeli ambassador from there. It was also just after the thing there. And it was fascinating, his take on the whole scene there.
What did he say?
I mean, the interesting thing, he said that anti-Semitism in India, it is non-existent.
Yes.
They know about it from reading books that it's happened somewhere, but... And India, after Indonesia, has the largest Muslim population in the world. They've got 115 million Muslims, but they're totally different to the Pakistani Muslims.
Hmm.
And it's the whole, you know, of course, Israeli defense industry would collapse if it wasn't for India, because Israel surpassed Russia as the main supply of arms to India.
No, there is a big problem there.
Yeah, this is what they're worried about. Then. But it says it's you know, this is why the whole thing was such a shock to the whole Indian population as well as this.
Mm. So he's the current Sharia who replaced Holzberg.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
In between they did not have anybody.
Well, in between they had Yeshiva Bachrim.
Yeah, okay.
They had Yeshiva Bachrim running it. But now it's a husband and a wife team, and they're there together, and they have a whole lot of things going. They have they're working a lot with the Mumbai Jews, the Jews who live in Mumbai, not only the Israeli backpackers and business people, but the
Bnei Israel and the Iraqis, the Baghdadis.
Well, the regular Mumbai, the Bombay Jews, of whom quite a number from Mumbai live in London. There's a strong Indian community. But they have a yeshiva going for them. They have a daily food, meals. They make about 40 meals a day. That's for the Israelis.
In the same premises?
Yeah, well, different premises. Mm-hmm. Different premises. You know, with high security, but it's packed with people every day. Look, that's another variety of the Vayeshev. You know, that's there's all the struggle, terrible things, tragic events, and then
being called.
Yeah, with the help of God. So here we have Yosef. He's 17 years old. He's with the children of Bilha and Zilpah,
and not with the children of Leah.
That's right, because there's a sense of conflict between him and the children of Leah, because Leah and Rachel were two rival wives, and there's this tension between them.
There's also something about Yaakov's personality that sort of keeps coming up. That he differentiates.
Well,
also when he expects Esau, when the way he kind of puts them at the back, Yosef and Rachel. So there is a father.
You mean
here,
the most protected?
Yeah,
position.
I mean, and children sense it. I mean, when you think today in psychology, I mean, this is a shocking way to behave. I picked on it because I had a father who preferred me on my sister and brother. And I'm paying for it now. And the whole family is in uproar because of that. I mean, there is an innate childish jealousy that will never go away between siblings when there is this preferential treatment. It's appalling.
And that was all from one mother.
Yeah, all from one mother. No, but back to that. I mean, this is shocking. And this is the only way you can understand the way, the cruel way in which they behaved.
Mm. Well, I mean, you still can't understand it.
Of course you can't. You can't. But on one level.
And on the other, you can't understand why Yaakov would do that. In fact, it says in the Code of Law, do not, when it's talking about the rules for parents towards children, it says don't show favoritism to one child over the other, as Jacob did with Joseph.
But do you know something? I think the whole Torah, the whole, all those stories are to teach us that this is not the way. He's paying for it. He's paying for it immediately, poor man. He paid for the fact that he cheated his brother. He was cheated immediately afterwards by Lavan. I mean, it's, you do wrong.
Funnily enough, that's not, the Jewish commentators don't look at it that way. The Christian commentators
do. No, but the human story
because,
is such, isn't
because
it?
The Jewish commentators see it as right that he should get the blessing. It was right that he should get the blessing.
No, I'm not talking about
But I can see another relationship in terms of what you're saying. Isaac preferred Esau. And Jacob prefers Joseph. You know, like...
Yes, it perpetuates, doesn't it?
But there's another thing here. I mean, he says it's the child of his old age. But Benjamin is younger.
Yes, that's an interesting point. That is an interesting point.
It seems like maybe, and again, I'm looking into the story as a, from a different perspective, nothing to do with that, that because he caused the death of Rachel, he was not that close to the boy.
Could be. Mm-hmm. Millie has another film in mind.
But could it be that Benjamin had not been born yet?
No, she's already dead.
Mother.
And because there's no mention of it, I mean, because it's so sparse in words.
It was my first thought about the... If he had lost his wife through the last child, he would not be close to the last child. I immediately thought.
Interesting.
But Amudamu Havatoa.
Yeah, but it does. On that level.
It's a logical story. Yeah.
All right, would you like to take the next verse 3? Would you like to take that?
The Israel.
Hello.
The Israel.
So I'll do it in English.
Okay, verse 3.
Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Since he was the child of his old age, he made Joseph a long, colorful coat.
Right, there is this colorful coat. That colorful coat is going to come up again. Would you like to go on? Vayiru echav.
Vayiru echav ki oto ahav aviyem ikol echav, vayisne'u oto, v'lo yachlut dabro l'shalom.
Wait, do you want to translate, please?
Yes, of course. The brothers witnessed that their father loved him more than themselves or his other brother, sons, and they hate him and they could not exchange any peaceful word with him.
Right. Now, Rashi says an interesting thing here. They couldn't speak peacefully to him. Rashi says, from criticizing them, you see what their good point is. It's true they couldn't speak peacefully to him, but it just shows that they were honest people. They weren't hypocrites. Because a hypocrite would have, been spoken very nicely, but actually hated the person. Whereas they were honest about what they felt. Mitoch gnutam lamadnu shvacham. From saying something bad about them, we learn praise of them. Shelo dibru achat bepe v'achat belev. They didn't say one thing with their mouth and mean something else in their heart.
That's why I prefer the French anti-Semitism to the British anti-Semitism. The French are open, and the Brits are not. The English are not.
Yeah.
But that's only a sideline.
A great teacher whom I knew, called Rabbi Mendel Hudefras, he said that in fact, with every person, their negative point is really their positive point as well. And he presented this as a philosophy of relating to people, you know, because very often there's something you can't stand about someone. In fact, that's a positive aspect of that person, but it's like just slightly the wrong way, or it's expressed in the wrong way. And because of that, there's something very negative about them, and so you see the negative. But one should realize that really those negative points are, in a certain sense, their positive points as well. It's a very subtle way. I mean, he's a person who went through many things. He was in a prison in Russia for 9 years. He encountered many different people. And this idea that the negative point of someone is also their positive point helps one relate to other people in a more more nuanced way. What are you saying?
In a more positive way.
In a more positive way, yes.
It's more genuine, isn't it?
Yes.
It's more honest.
Well, some people are just bad, and that's all there is to it, but...
Well, yeah, but every bad person, there's normally another face to it.
But everybody has twinges of, not everybody, I mean, myself, you have aspects of your life which go into bad degrees and things, which allow you to identify.
Mm. You mean when you see a negative thing in another person?
You can identify part yourself.
Yes.
Down that road a bit.
Well, very often, what we really dislike in someone else is something very much in us, and we see that in the other person. That's what gets us so annoyed.
The thing that I wonder though is, these are great sages, aren't they? These are great sadhaks, these people. And yet, if they're sadhaks, how are they capable of doing things which we would consider bad?
Shows you they were human.
But they're all human.
No, but sadhak is a higher level of human, isn't it? So why is their heart allowing them to do this?
Well, they had it thrust upon them rather than they achieved it.
Because they came through it, so they said it because they...
Well, I mean,
I like that.
Yeah. Say it again.
So they said it because they survived this.
I mean, I think what Michael says is interesting. It's thrust upon them. In the sense that everything that they're going to do is going to have immense consequences for the future. It's they are living in such a way that whatever they do is going to have reverberations, because they are the ancestors of the Jewish people, and all the different streams of the Jewish people are going to come out of them. And the struggle that they have, we cannot imagine. There's a famous story in the Talmud about a rabbi in the Talmud, in the Talmudic period, and he was reading the Bible, and he read about a certain king in the Book of Kings who worshipped idols. And he was thinking to himself, how ridiculous, how absurd that this king should serve idols, what a terrible thing. And that night he had a dream, and he dreamt of that king in the Bible. And the king says to him, the king gets into a conversation with him, and he can see that this king is a very great sage, tremendously great sage. And he says, I just want to ask, if you're such a great sage, why did you serve idols? So he said, if you would have been living in my time, ropes would not have held you back from serving idols. You just don't know what the desire was for us. You know, so the passions that people felt at this point. It's,
when I say thrust of mine, it's also, I don't think they had a choice.
Well, that's an interesting question, because you see, for example, in this Sedra, we do come to a few choices. Let's maybe skip ahead.
No, they didn't have a choice of who they were.
And what you do is not necessarily one of the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But we go back to that thing that everything was predestined to these people anyway, wasn't it?
Predestined. You know, we can say that for us too, everything is predestined. What we did is predestined. But what we actually do is in our hands. And we can say that about them as well. What they did.
Well, then what are those prophecies of this and this and this will happen?
You know, I heard an interesting discussion of this by the Rebbe some time ago. And there is a principle in halakha that if a prophet prophesies a positive thing and it doesn't happen, so we say he's a false prophet. Mm-hmm. But if he prophesies a negative thing and it doesn't happen, we say, oh, well, the people repented, or,
exactly,
you know. Yeah. So negative prophecies can always be dissolved. Negative prophecies do not have to come about, even in the Torah. So so that idea of, you know, in other words, he's defending the idea of free will, even in the face of a prophecy, which seems to be saying that this and this is going to happen, but there's still free will.
But there's this element, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
You know, so obviously there are...
Well, Maimonides says that was a punishment for the evil that Pharaoh had already done.
Was it for that, or was it for other reason, that the Israelite will see the whole 10 plagues and
well,
all the
well,
rest of it?
Well, Maimonides puts it as a punishment in terms of God and Pharaoh. That was a punishment to Pharaoh because of the evil things that Pharaoh had already done relating to the Jews. So he very much defends the concept of free will, and he discusses exactly those verses. And then there's, you see, when God hardens one's heart, does that really mean that one has no control? There is a concept which it's said, there's a little diary of Hasidic sayings, which the Rebbe, it was the first book the Rebbe edited, it was in 1943. And it's a little saying for each day. So the saying for tomorrow is, one of the basic concepts of Chabad thought is that the mind controls the heart. So in other words, if one's heart is hard, one can use the mind to soften it.
And the other way around, if it's too soft, then the mind, because there has to be a balance.
Well, yes. I mean, the mind, it can control what the heart feels. The current atmosphere in Western culture, at least in its sort of creative form, is that people are led by their hearts. Someone falls in love. The different ways in which hearts draw people.
Greed
from one
to do
thing.
With the heart?
Well, greed, yes.
Greed,
that's
greed.
A lust in the heart.
Greed.
Mm-hmm. But the mind, according to Jewish teaching, the mind can control that. There is a way of resolving them. And maybe that's why we invented psychotherapy. Which is a very interesting thing. The idea that the uncontrollable, psychotic passions in a person's heart and fears can be resolved by quiet conversation or a series of quiet conversations for 10 years.
Yes, and with a bit of luck, it works.
I'd like to hear your wife's opinion on that.
No, he's quoting her.
Okay, that's yes.
Oh, some people run a kind of express form of therapy today. Someone I know that you know, three sessions, you know.
Oh yes,
speed therapy.
Well, there was a famous example. Somebody came to Jung, a woman, and said that she wanted therapy and that she'll need 5 or 10 sessions. That would be it, and that was it. So she knew how much she needed, what she wanted to do.
Hmm.
It's one of the
before or after
biographies or memoirs of Fire Jung or anyhow.
All right. So then he has his dreams. He has the dreams, which you remember, there's the dream of the sheaves in the field, and the dream which they're all making sheaves in the field, his sheaf stands up and all the other sheaves bow down to his sheaf. Mm. Then there's his dream of the sun, moon and stars, and they're all bowing down to him. And these dreams upset his brothers, and his father tells him off. And it's interesting that one dream is about material things, sheaves in the field, and the other is about heavenly things, the sun, moon, and stars. Mm. And the Rebbe comments on this. It is indicating that our material and our spiritual life should be in harmony. Whatever we're doing, the material and the spiritual should be in harmony. That there's, There's no separation between them. So making sheaves in the field or something in the heavens, it's all one. All right, now then, there comes a point where his father sends him to go and see what his brothers are doing, and that's verse 14.
From Hebron to Shechem, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Vayomer lo, Jacob says to Joseph, Nigel, would you like to take this?
Is that... Yeah.
Verse 14.
Let's see how you run. I should read it in English.
Yeah, okay, then see.
Then see how your brothers and the sheep are doing, said Israel. Bring me a report. Israel thus sent him from the Hebron Valley, and Joseph arrived in Shechem. The stranger found him blundering about in the field. What are you looking for? Asked the stranger. I'm looking for my brothers, replied Joseph. Perhaps you can tell me where they are tending the sheep. They already left this area, said the man. I heard them planning to go to Dothan.
Okay, now there are a couple of points I'd like to make about this. First of all, this mention of Hebron. Jacob sent Joseph from the valley of Hebron. Now, valley is Emek, which means depths. From the depths of Hebron. Now Hebron is where Abraham is buried. And Abraham was told, your children will be slaves in a land which is not theirs. In other words, Abraham was told about the exile in Egypt. In order for the prophecy to Abraham to be fulfilled, a chain of events is being set in process now. And that is why there's this irrational event of Jacob sending Joseph to look for his brothers when he should have been aware, and he was aware, that his brothers didn't like Joseph. His other sons didn't like Joseph. Why is he sending Joseph alone off to them? There's likely to be an argument, at least. And nonetheless, it's because of the depths of Hebron that in order to fulfill this prophecy given to Abraham. So in that sense, you know, this idea of a complex interaction of souls, of spiritual teachings, of prophecies, and somehow or other, whatever we do as ourselves as individuals, we have free will, if you like. But nonetheless, there are certain things which are going to work themselves out around us. And so here it is something
so
which
there
is
a map, but it's not, it's kind of a drawing, and we kind of fill it up with color as we go along.
Well, it's interesting because it's really many dimensional. Mm. It's more than, it's a multi-dimensional grid. And we're at this point in it, and maybe at the same time we're at another point, and it somehow reformats, and then we're somewhere else, and each step that we make somehow transforms reality. So the thoughts in a person's mind affect the reality in which we're living, as we see from the Yiddish phrase, Tracht gut, werd sein gut. Think good, and it will be good. So that way. And in an intriguing way, quantum mechanics seems to talk about the idea that man's consciousness has some effect on existence around him. So there is this. Tracht gut, werd sein gut.
Do we believe our thoughts have impact on others if they're not actualized?
Yeah.
A good thought. Really believe
well, first of all, there's Machshava Tova HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mitzachfa L'maseh. Good thoughts. God joins them to actions. So it's as if there's an effect that the good thoughts have. And in terms of our relationships with other people, there is the idea of thinking good about another person, and that will help them think good about you, about each other.
It's not, I don't think it's so much that our good thoughts have impact on other people. Our good thoughts have impact on us, and then the way we approach life has a different outcome.
I have been called naive thinking that.
Yeah, sure.
Well, yeah, but you could, but you could say that there is actually an effect. There's a verse that actually affects the other person. Kamayim hapanim lapanim, like the water. It's like a person is looking at a pool of water. Kamayim hapanim, like the water of the face. Lapanim looks at the face. In other words, if you smile at the water, it smiles back at you.
To you, yes.
And if you frown, it'll frown back at you. Kein lev ha'adam la'adam. So is the heart of one person to another.
That's very true.
So if you work on thinking good thoughts about another person, they respond. I've seen this myself.
Yes.
I must say, there is a in the before one goes to sleep at night. Traditionally, one says the Shema. One says Shema, it's a very beautiful moment before going to sleep saying the Shema. Now, different prayer books have different, like, order of saying the Shema, and they have a little bit before and a little bit after, this and that. In the Chabad prayer book, it says like this: Master of the universe, I hereby forgive anyone who upset me in any way during the day. And you sort of think about, you know, was there anyone who upset me? And if I upset them, I feel bad about that. And you sort of think through what happened in the day. And that is a good recipe for having good relationships with people. Because if someone did upset you, you think to yourself, he did this. Never mind.
Sleep in
peace. That's right. You sleep in peace and you ask, let no one be punished on my account.
And it ends with asking forgiveness for all our, that will be instead of all our sins as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it goes like on that. With the Yom Kippur, Shandu Bagandu, yes. But it's a very beautiful idea to resolve one's relationship with another person in one's own mind, and with the help of God, that has an effect on them as well. Yes. All right, so now then this man meets him. Vayimtza'il ish. He met this man. Who is this man?
Found him blundering about in the field.
Right. Now the question is, who is the man? Who is himself?
And they said
ready.
They don't say angel, they say ish.
Yes, well, Rashi says this is an angel.
An angel.
And it's the angel Gavriel.
Yeah.
As we see elsewhere in the Bible, Vaha'ish Gavriel, the man Gavriel. So the fact that he uses the word Ish, Vaha'ish Gavriel, the man Gavriel, it uses that somewhere else, that links into here that this Ish is Gavriel, and this is Gavriel directing him to his brothers in order that the whole, everything will unfold. Well, it's really getting late. What happens is he comes to the brothers and they say, let's put him to death, or let they we'll see what happens to him. Verse 21.
Vayishma Ruven.
Yeah, Vayishma Ruven. Would you like to say that, please?
Yeah, Vayishma Ruven. Vayatzilehu. Miadam vayomer lo nakeinu nefesh.
Right.
Vayama aleihem Reuven al tishbehu dam hashlichu oto el habor haze asher b'midbar v'yad al tashlichu bo lemaran hatzil oto miadam lahashivo al aviv.
Right, would you like to translate?
Reuben heard these words and tried to rescue Joseph. Let's not kill him, he said. Reuben tried to reason with his brothers. Don't commit bloodshed. You can throw him into this well in the desert and you won't have to lay a hand on him. His plan was to rescue Joseph from his brothers and bring him back to his father.
Right, so Reuven doesn't want to sell him, Reuven wants or do anything bad to him, Reuven wants to bring him back to his father. However, the next thing that happens is that they drag him out of the pit, they see some caravans going by, they decide, let's sell him, and they drag him out of the pit and they sell him to a caravan of merchants. And then we come to verse 29. Michael, would you like to try that? That's on...
Vayeshev.
Well.
Vayashav. Vayashav.
Yeah. Vayashav Ruven. Verse 20.
Vayashav Ruven El Habor.
Mm-hmm.
Vihene ends Yosef. Babor. Vayikra et Begadav.
Begadav. Yeah. Say the next verse.
Vayashav El Echav Vayomer Yaled.
Okay, would you like to translate, please?
Read the English.
Okay.
When Reuben returned to the world, Joseph was no longer there. He tore his clothes in grief, returned to his brothers. The boy is gone, he exclaimed. And I, where can I go?
Right. Reuben is desolate. Joseph is gone, he's been sold. Now the question is, where was Reuben? Surely, he was the one. He had a whole argument with his brothers. His brothers wanted to kill Joseph there and then. And he said, don't kill him. Let's put him in a pit. And his whole intention was to rescue him later. And now he's come back. Where's he come back from?
From, yeah.
What's... Now here we have another case. And this is a case of false piety. Piety in the wrong place. Because Reuven was a very, very penitential individual. In last week's Sedra, it tells us that Reuven slept with one of his father's concubines.
Oh, that's right, yes, with Bilhah.
And he took this terribly seriously. Now, of course, you know, there's another way of looking at it. He didn't actually sleep with her, it was something else. But whatever it was, Reuven took it very seriously, and he had a whole penitential order of activity in order to make up for this tragic thing. And as a result, he wasn't in the right place at the right time. He went away in order to engage in some like hermit-like, you know, penitential prayers, at a time when he should have been sitting by the pit making sure that nothing went wrong with Joseph. So it's another warning, you know, if you look at Jacob marrying two wives, that it was right for him to marry two wives, even though he was keeping the extra mitzvah of the later Torah teachings. No, in this case, he marries two wives. And Reuven, he muffed it over here, he miffed it. Because he was concerned about his own piety and his own spiritual level instead of keeping his eye on the ball and looking after Joseph. And so that is another teaching about the whole way in which we have to balance our lives and be able to balance the spiritual with the material. And that goes again with Joseph's two dreams. One dream is about material things, another dream is about spiritual things. The material and the spiritual have to combine together. And it's very easy for us to veer off in one direction or the other direction. And both of them are erroneous. If we're able to keep that balance, then there is a healthy life and everything goes in the right way. So that's the point where we've got to at this moment. With Joseph, now Jacob, they've gone back to Jacob, they've shown him the garments, the ktonet pasim, the multicolored garment, which they've dipped in the blood of a ram that they've slaughtered. And he is now weeping, and it's a terrible thing. And meanwhile, they sell him into Egypt. And then we have the whole story of Judah. Judah with Tamar, and Judah's three sons, and he, because his first two sons die, he doesn't want Tamar to marry the third son. And she knows that this is a sacred family, and she has to have a child from this family. And so therefore, she disguises herself as a prostitute, and she sits by the wayside. And just at this time, Judah's wife has passed away. And time has gone by, and somehow he notices this prostitute. And he wants to be with her. And she says, so what will you give me? And he promises her something, like a goat, or two goats. She says, can you give me a pledge till you give me the goat? So he gives her a signet ring and staff and other things. He gives her various things. He sleeps with her. And then he goes away, and then he tries to send with a servant of his, a friend of his, he tries to send the goats that he's promised her to get the pledge back, and he can't find this prostitute, and the people say there's no harlot. There's never been a harlot over here. It's a whole mysterious story. And then he's told that his daughter-in-law is pregnant, which means she must have gone with someone illicitly. And this is a terrible thing, and he's the judge of the town. He says, take her and let her be burnt. Awful punishment. And then she says, producing the signet and the staff and the string, the thong, she says, I am pregnant from the man to whom these belong. And he said, Tzotko mimeni, she is more righteous than me, it's my child. And then she gave birth. And she gave birth to a child. One child was called Peretz, and the other was called Zorach. And Peretz is the ancestor of Boaz, and Boaz married Ruth, and is the ancestor of King David, who is the ancestor of the Messiah. So, it's
that's the one thing. It's all interlinked.
It's all interlinked. And then it moves on to the story of Joseph in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar's wife desires Joseph. There's something special there as well. And in fact, it says that Joseph, later on, that's in the next sedra, marries a woman called Osnas Bas Potiphera. Osnas, the daughter of Potiphar, who is the daughter of this woman who tried to have an affair with him. And that daughter, there's something about her genealogy. She had a locket, and Joseph was very handsome, and the girls were throwing things at him. And so there was this locket which was thrown at him. And he picked up the locket and he opened it. And inside it said, Bat Yaakov, the daughter of Jacob. That somehow or other this is from Dina. It's a granddaughter of Dina who was seduced by Shechem. And that child has somehow now ended up in Egypt. And here is the...
Is it a midrash, obviously?
Yeah. But it means that... that also there's some kind of spiritual magnetism taking place over him. And then Joseph is in prison. And when he's in prison, he's much beloved by the other prisoners and by the man in charge of the prison. And in a sense, that's really, I think, an enduring message. That wherever one is, one has to be. There's a text that one reads when one visits the grave of a tzaddik. It's called Ma'ane Lashon, Ma'ane Lashon. It's an old text going back a few hundred years when people used to, in the Middle Ages, would go to the graves of different sages, tzaddikim. And it says there, you're praying to God, you're saying, please God, I should be she'er yemin hamo'ilim. I should be one of those who are useful in the world, in some way to be useful. And whether it's as a person with great power and authority, or someone who's in a prison, we should be able to be useful and effective in a positive way. And that, in fact, is the mysterious thing about Joseph. Joseph was able to be connected with God in every situation in life. And that's why when the butler and the baker, who were in prison with him, and they had dreams they couldn't understand, he said, listen, God can explain dreams, so tell me your dream and God will help me answer it, in effect. That's what he said. And the brothers of Joseph, why were they jealous of him? The brothers of Joseph were shepherds. They were deeply pious, spiritual people. But they could only maintain that spirituality while they were far from the hurly-burly of life. When you're a shepherd on the hillside and it's just a flock of sheep, then they were able to feel close to God. Joseph was able to feel close to God in any situation whatsoever. Even when in the next sedra he is an organizer and running a whole concern. Nonetheless, even though he walks here and there, this is from the Zohar, even though he walks here and there in the realm of impurity of different kinds, the image of God is within him all the time. So that's the image of Joseph. Yosef HaTzadik. Okay.
There is a blessing or a prayer or something, a little prayer about Ein Bisha, about Ein Ra'a, and it comes from the blessing that Yaakov blessed Yosef. I'm going into a different tandem now. Ein Ra'a.
Yeah.
Why? Not why, but is it something that is? It isn't a Jewish. It isn't in the Bible, so obviously one does believe in it.
I'm just trying to find this.
I've seen a text in Aramaic. Ana Mizar'a de Yosef, or something like that.
Ben Porat Yosef. Ben Porat Ale Ayin. A fruitful son is Joseph. Ale Ayin. Now, this word, Ale Ayin, that's what you're referring to.
Is it? I don't know. That's what I was asking, because I was referring to something that I saw written as sort of an amelut against Ein Ra'a, and Yosef is mentioned there.
Interesting. That's because the point is that people would look at him in his beauty. And that's this Ale Ayin. But there's also the idea that
he did not attract evil eye.
Yeah, it's protected. Yeah. And the reason why he's protected in that way is because he tried to protect his mother. When Esav was coming towards Jacob and his children, so Joseph stood in front of Rachel so that he shouldn't, that Esau shouldn't see. Benot tzada leshur, the ayin hara should not rule over Joseph's descendants. And when Jacob blessed Manasseh and Ephraim, who were the sons of Joseph, he blessed them like fish, which are also immune from the Ein Hara, from the evil eye.
Is that why some people have fish on a...
Maybe, I don't know. I mean,
it's one of those things that you see a lot in the markets in Israel.
Okay, that's a whole other dimension of
what
Kabbalah Ma'asit, which I do not have anything to do with.
The fish is also very Christianity.
It's fertility. It's a sign of fertility, usually in Islam and in Christianity.
You can't get away from the filter fish.
Fertility. Yes, fertility.
The idea of fish have lots of baby fish.
For Muslim and Christian, it's a sign of fertility.
They could have had a mouse.
But. I think the approach of the Rebbe, you know, to things of this kind, is that the best insurance for spiritual protection are the mitzvot of the Torah themselves. The mitzvot of the Torah, and study of Torah, they protect the person and they strengthen the person, and so all these negative things do not have. They don't have an effect. So, for the most part, you know. I mean, sometimes there's.
No, I was going through the premise. Does it actually exist? I mean, is it something that, although we have it and we hear it, but that's another thing.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, it's the obverse of what we were saying before. If a person's good thoughts about someone have a positive effect, then one can imagine the negative of that, that if a person has bad thoughts about someone, if someone is jealous, then that's also going to have an effect. And so one needs... But with the help of God... If we have good thoughts, then no one will have bad thoughts about us, and so then it'll just be a chain of good thoughts, and everything will be possible. So, with the help of God. So, that is the Sedra Vayeshev.
Thank you.
Thank you.